So it's a pleasure to talk to you, and I've enjoyed being here and listening to the talks and talks on the web. And so Robin asked me to speak today, and I think I really should have changed the title to something like, this is just sort of random thoughts and musings that I have about cancer and stiffness in the tumor microenvironment. And I think I want to, yeah. And I think what I wanted to do was just sort of start out by telling you about some of the important or some of the big questions. I'm not necessarily working on these, but I thought it'd be something worth bringing to your attention. One question is, why are some cancers more prevalent in some parts of the world than others? And I'm going to show you some epidemiology, because we really, or I haven't seen that much epidemiology in this workshop. Another is, why does a tumor start where it does in an organ? In other words, you have lung cancer, why does it start in that spot and not some other spot of the lung? And the third question is, what is the role of mechanical stiffness of the ECM, the extracellular matrix, or the tumor microenvironment in promoting invasive cancer? And I'll take some time to go into that. So the two questions that we're starting to work or think a little bit about are these last two, but I thought the first one was interesting also. I think if I have a bottom line for this whole talk or some message I'd like to communicate, it would be this. Genes are not the whole story. We've done a marvelous job at sequencing the human genome, and we know that genes, you know, dictate what proteins are being expressed, and there's of course epigenetics, which helps regulate that, and Arnie Levine talked very nicely about that. So we tend to view cancer in terms of the genes. If we can figure out the genes, and we can figure out what they're doing, and the proteins, how they're interacting, then we've got it. And I would argue, I don't think so, not quite. I think there are other important players. I'm going to be talking about some about the tumor microenvironment. There's going to be later talks in this program, I understand, on the tumor microenvironment in particular. Mina Bissell will be coming in about a month, and she has certainly done really seminal work in this field, so that should be an excellent talk. Another thing which I know nothing about, but also mitochondria, if you think about things not so much as just information, but also energy, and if you look at some of like Douglas Wallace's work, I think mitochondria also plays a big role, but I know nothing about that, so don't ask. So, okay. So let's, I'm just going to give a very sort of broad general introduction. This is some of this I gave a talk at the March meeting. Every time I hit the lights, they go on.
It's the other side.
Okay.
What you have is the light, is the small round lights that are...
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to kill, the small round lights.
But on the very other side, you have these blackboard lights.
Yeah, but those are okay.
Or do you want me to... decreasing the temperature.
Do you want me to kill those?
On the right.
No, those are screens.
Oh, yeah. Okay, those are...
That's good enough. Okay, so... incidence of cancer worldwide. I'm going to start from a very big length scale of the world. By the end of the talk, I'll go down to the small length scale of proteins. But basically, there's we know a lot of people get cancer. How many people? There are about 12, 13 million new cases diagnosed every year. So 7 million people, of those 12, 13 million, 7 million people will die of cancer this year. In the U.S., about 600,000 people will die of cancer this year. It's estimated that during their lifetime, 1 in 2 men will be diagnosed with cancer, and 1 in 3 women. So that means people in this room, and if you're thinking, well, I'll be one of the ones that isn't, you don't get to choose. Okay, so here are the breakdown. This is the number of people who get cancer in, say, 1 year versus, and that year I think is about, what, 2008? And this is broken down by different regions of the world. The red line is the incidence of cancer. The blue line is the people who died of cancer, mortality. And so the first thing is the world. And then if you look at this, it looks like the Caribbean and South Africa are the places to be if you want to avoid getting cancer. That's where you want to choose to live. Where's North America? That's, and over here, East Asia has a lot of people. Western Europe is also over here.
Shouldn't you normalize by the population?
Yeah, you should. So let's do that. This is the age standardized rate. So you should normalize. So one reason why you could say maybe Caribbean and South Africa don't have so many rates of cancer is, you know, they're dying of typhoid in the Caribbean, they're dying of AIDS and whatever in South Africa. They don't live that long, they don't clean water, they're not that many people, so yeah, you're not going to have too many people die there of cancer. They don't live that long, they're not that many. Whereas in East Asia, we've just got a lot of people there, so you're going to have more deaths, more cancer. So if we normalize it, this is the age standardized rate per 100,000. So the age standardized rate is, you don't want to say just, okay, in Japan they live longer, so they have more old people, and other places where they die young, they have more young people. And so you want to sort of weight each age group equally. And you also want to normalize it by the population. If you do that, you get the age standardized rate. And so now it's broken down again by different parts of the world. This is the world here. Again, red is incidence. And so you can see Australia, North America, very high incidence. Western Europe, very high incidence of cancer. Mortality is not that high. Mortality is more or less interesting, more or less kind of flat compared to this. Okay, so but it could be that in the more developed countries we have better detection methods, and so that may be why you have a higher incidence.
Why did you exclude non-melanoma skin cancers? There was already in the last talk, it said something.
So non-melanoma skin cancers, if you think about it, most of them are basal cell carcinoma. That's 99% curable. It really doesn't metastasize. It's just you excise it and it's, you're done, right? So it's really, it's technically speaking, it's a cancer, but it doesn't kill anybody, right? So you know, you want to look at kind of cancers of interest because people die from it, right? And this is the problem. You're not really having people dying so much from them. Melanoma is the one that you have to worry about because that one will metastasize. It is probably the most aggressive form of cancer. Okay, so cancer statistics, what are the different kinds of cancer? Again, this is the age standardized rate, so this has been normalized per 100,000 people. This is the blue is incidence, so you've got commonly diagnosed cancers are lung, breast, colorectal. The most common causes of death are from lung, stomach, and liver. And you'll notice these are the ones that are sort of harder to diagnose early, to detect early. So causes of cancer, you know this, they're genes, they're environmental factors, carcinogens and radiation, sunlight, lifestyle, you know, we're all eating too much fast food and smoking, obesity, occupation, you can be exposed to hazardous things. I put in here, interestingly, maybe you're not aware of night shift. People who do the night shift have a higher incidence of cancer, higher cancer risk than if you don't do the night shift. As you probably know, viruses and bacteria can cause cancer. So these are just a few of the, you know, HPV causes, a few strains of HPV causes cervical cancer, hepatitis B and C, liver, leukemia can be caused by cancer, H. pylori, which causes ulcers, can cause stomach cancer, and so forth. So Arnie Levine taught some about that. And
night shift has something to do with stress?
Circadian clock.
Circadian, is it the circadian? I don't know if it's really understood. The circadian rhythm is what he's talking about. Maybe if you're doing the night shift, you eat more fast food. Maybe lack of sleep, you don't sleep well. I don't think it's not understood. I don't know.
It's very hormonal.
Hormonal.
That's hormonal.
Melatonin, for example.
So, yeah, one of the One of the people groups, actually, I just mentioned this, that doesn't get cancer except for leukemia and testicular cancer are people who have Down syndrome. They tend not to get, they don't get solid tumor cancers. People thought it's because they didn't live long enough. They tended to die before they were 30. Then they started living longer and they still don't get solid tumor cancers. And so why is that? Some people, Judah Folkman said, well, maybe it's because he thinks they have a higher level of endostatins and don't have so much angiogenesis. But we don't know. So here's the number of cancer deaths versus the year of death. And the blue line is for men, and this one is for women. And the red line is just an extrapolation. And so you can see, for one thing, the number of cancer deaths has not decreased over the years. It's not going up anymore. And the fact that it didn't keep going up, the National Cancer Institute decided, well, then they sort of thought this was good. They've obviously been successful. But it's sort of not very comforting, the thought that in the U.S. you're not really decreasing the number of cancer deaths in spite of all the amount of research and all the billions of dollars that have been spent. So what can physics do for cancer? Well, of course, or what can be done to lower the cancer mortality, you know, prevention. If you think about it, the way we conquered polio was not by making better iron lungs, it was by having a vaccine. Early detection is something that helps, and if we have new scientific advances, new approaches, new technologies, and I think we should have a greater exchange of research information. The physicists, we have a preprint library. Biologists and cancer biologists will never have a preprint library, nor are they interested in a preprint library. And I think that lack of information exchange hampers progress. So because the cancer rate wasn't going down, the National Cancer Institute, which is one of the institutes of the National Institutes of Health, decided to take $150 million and start 12 physical sciences oncology centers around the country. And so hopefully they wanted physicists to take a look, and maybe we can say something. Bob Austin will be here in about a month, and he heads the one at Princeton.
I have a question. Go back to a slide where you showed that the cancer rate's not going down. The question is, why was it going up between 1975 and 1980, 89 or so, the blue line?
I think, so the question is whether we were actually, you know, the short answer is I don't really know. It could be that we had, lifespan was getting longer. You know, you have the campaign against smoking, so you have fewer people, men, smoking. So at some point, you got rid of some of the other causes of death, but now you bump up against
Well, it's neither age nor population size adjusted.
Yeah, this is just right. This is just pure number of deaths.
There's probably the growth in population size. Possibly. That's all it is, but maybe.
Or aging of the
population. Yeah, or our population is still kind of growing, right?
The U.S., it is.
Oh. Yeah. Yeah, so the population is growing, and I don't know that we're, it's going, but I guess, the pressing thing is not going down. You know, you think with all of these breakthroughs that we hear about every week.
Well, no, I'm saying it's a little misleading, right? I mean, if this is not corrected for population size, mm-hmm. and the population in the U.S. is actually increasing,
yeah.
that level
yeah.
curve means that it's actually dropping, for all you know.
It
should be adjusted for age.
Obviously, you should have just the same plot for the age-adjusted.
You should have the age-standardized rate. Yeah, okay. Right. And so this comes from a different source.
This looks like a politics slide.
this is what the National Cancer Institute said. Look, see, we're doing a good job, right? We lowered it.
Yeah, they won't fund me.
It could be worse. So of course, you know, physicists, we have traditionally provided tools. For medical applications. I think there's a real need for quantitative measurements. Too often I look at cancer biology papers and I see just a lot of pictures, and being a theorist, I want numbers that I can compare models to. So that I think is a challenge. So if we get to the first question that I raised, why are some cancers more prevalent in some parts of the world than others? If you look at, say, prostate cancer, right, you have prostate cancer tends to be more prevalent in the developed countries, Australia, Western Europe, North America. and much less so, say, in Africa, this is the standardized thing. Breast cancer is same. You've got breast cancer and prostate cancer, very similar, actually. Both are hormonal, so you have a large incidence in the developed countries, and less so in, like, East Asia, very low. On the other hand, if you look at liver cancer, who's leading in liver cancer? East Asia and China, very high incidence and hence mortality of liver cancer. And if you look at where Western Europe, North America, and New Zealand are, we have very low liver cancer rates. So why do you have more liver cancer here and more breast cancer in another place? Liver cancer, we kind of do know. That's because hepatitis B and C tend to be endemic in China and East Asia. It's just passed in birth when the children are born. So that chronic infection does raise the risk of liver cancer. But it does raise an issue as to why some parts have more one kind of cancer than another.
But if you go back, right, I would say for prostate cancer, right, I mean, the higher incidence in Western Europe and in North America.
Infection?
It's just from screening. You know, but there's a lot more screening in there than you have in developing countries. That's all it is, actually.
Yeah.
Mortality is constant.
Mortality is more or less constant. If I look here, mortality.
So most of that, I think, just comes from.
Yeah, but if I look at East Asia, right? If I look at mortality, there's a factor of about 2 or 3 here between East Asia and Europe for breast cancer. So if I just look at mortality, okay, I don't look at an incidence, which
right.
is detected.
So part of that, right, is that it's known that for example, the mortality rate for various cancer, it's slightly dependent on actually the ethnic background. So for prostate cancer, actually, right, if you go back again, right, actually there is a slight background effect. Africans actually have higher testosterone level and actually overall has more prostate cancer than actually Caucasians, for example. But yeah, right, I mean, if you look, right, the...
Inside the U.S., you mean?
No, it's actually found both inside the U.S. and also actually when they test Africans.
Yeah. So that's true, yes. So it's got 9.3 here for Southern Africa and 8 for Western Africa. So yeah. Another question I had was, why does a tumor start where it does? I mean, if you say, okay, it's genes, you say it's what you ate, it's your exposure to the environment. Are you really going to say that this part of your brain had more exposure than that part? You know, the question is, why does a tumor start where it does in an organ? Why does the brain tumor start here, the lung tumor start here? This is interesting in breast cancer, for example. Most breast tumors start in the upper half of the breast. So the arm is going out here. You've got 36.3% in the upper outer near the arm, upper inner 9%. So it's almost 50% here. But if you add these up, it's more like 11% than lower outer and lower inner. So why does it start more in the upper than the lower? And I'll come back to that in a couple minutes.
How come it doesn't sum to 100%?
It does. If you add all these up, I actually went through, I was worried about that. I actually went through, if you sum up all these numbers, 15.74% is not available, but if you actually add up every single number I have on this chart, it comes to 100%. There's some of the border. 19.3 is the borderlines between the quadrants. 0.9% is the axilla, which is going out to the arm, the armpit, if you will. The stat applies to both breasts, and you have a central portion here of 6.2%. So actually, if you add them up, it does. Okay, so breast cancer. 2012, it's estimated that, you know, about over 200,000 women will be diagnosed in the U.S. with invasive breast cancer. 60,000 will be diagnosed with sort of stage zero in situ breast cancer. 40,000 women will die of breast cancer this year, and men, you're not immune. It's rare, but about 2,000 men are diagnosed with breast cancer. So 2 years ago, I was part of these statistics. I had stage one cancer. I'm breast cancer. I'm fine now, but it got me interested in the subject. It gave me a passion, and also, I got a glimpse of the clinical side of this, which can be interesting. So breast cancer incidence increases exponentially with age. Here's the rate of 100,000. This is the rate at age of diagnosis. This is non-invasive. I'll explain that later. Invasive cancer is a function of age. 80% of the new diagnoses are in women 50 years or older, and 75% of the mortality are in women 50 years and older. So after 30 years of extensive genomic studies, there's still no smoking. Yeah.
And when you say exponentially, for instance, for different population, you have the same different baseline with the same slope?
So you're saying if you go to other countries?
It's a question.
I suspect so. I don't know. I'm guessing. So the short answer is I don't know, but I think so. I think age, basically what you've got, if you say, you know, whatever is causing all of these things, basically problems with the genes or whatever, that's just going to be a lot of things just increase exponentially with age. So incidence, yeah. I mean, cancer is a disease of aging. Right, because you have sort of accumulative, with the exceptions of what we heard, you know, these genetic things that we heard this morning. So this comes to this idea that I don't think genes, while key and important, are not the only player in town. And after 30 years of extensive genetic studies, there's still no genetic smoking gun that can explain 95% of breast cancers. Sure, genes play a role. We heard about P53. There's the BRCA 1 and 2 genes that are known that are hereditary. But an example of how heterogeneous this is and how genes doesn't just tell the whole story is that last year, some people did whole genome sequencing of 50 breast cancer tumors. These were all what's called estrogen receptor positive, but they had something in common. And from 50 tumors, they found 1,700 gene mutations. And only 3 of those mutations appeared in 10% or more of the tumors. So you have 30 to 80 gene mutations per tumor. And not only that, I mean, people have looked at tumors from different parts of a tumor, sequenced genes from different parts of a tumor from the same person, and they find different gene mutations, or even different, if it's metastasized, different locations, and there you see different gene mutations. So this is one cancer that's incredibly heterogeneous genetically. Let me go back to bring in the idea of stiffness. So stiffer, denser breasts have a higher risk for breast cancer, and the thing that makes it stiffer and denser are things like collagen, or this fibrous tissue. So a breast can have both fat in it and sort of fibrous collagen type things. The more collagen it has, the stiffer it is. And this shows up in a mammogram as white stuff. So if you think about it, this is air, right? So air is dark, very low density things are dark. High density things show up white in a mammogram. So if you have a lot of white stuff, that corresponds to higher mammographic density. And it's stiffer, and that correlates with a higher risk of breast cancer. So mammograms are always ranked with a grade of basically 1 to 4, or 0 to 25%, where you don't have much fibrous stuff, mostly fat, all the way up to 75 to 100%. That quartile is extremely dense. And people in the 75 to 100% are twice as likely to get breast cancer as those in the second quartile, are 4 times more likely than in the first. So let's go back to the question I raised before of why do you have more tumors in the upper half than the lower half? And my question is, and I don't know the answer to this, is the mammographic density higher in the upper half than the lower half? And I don't think anyone's really looked at the distribution of this white stuff. we're going to try to do that this summer, but one question is how is stiffness distributed? So let me talk a little bit about the structure of the breast. It's designed, of course, to produce milk.
Sorry, before you jump, since you're saying, emphasizing stiffness, the data you have is just the density of fibril material, right? Whereas the stiffness would also be related, for example, I mean, you can assume that that should be linked, but the stiffness will also be connected to how much linker proteins you have between the fibrils. So it's not trivial that your optical density equals stiffness.
That's true. But people have done studies just on mammographic density. Right, so the studies that have been done have been looking purely at mammographic density. They didn't measure no rheology, they don't measure stiffness, and they see this correlation. Okay, so you just kind of empirically know that the denser ones, it's mostly collagen, they do tend to be stiffer as opposed to just fat. But you're absolutely right. If you don't look at the cross-linking, you don't know. But if you look just, forget stiffness, pure mammographic density, that increases the risk, higher risk of breast cancer with higher mammographic density, regardless of cross-linking. So, so breasts are designed to produce and deliver milk. So this is, so what you have are these ducts or pipes. At the ends are these lobules. So in the duct, what you have is a structure of a duct. The cross-section would look like this. The little particles here are milk. These endothelial cells or epithelial cells line it. Those are just epithelial cells. Around that, you have these little red cells. Those are myoepithelial cells. So those are sort of like little muscle cells. They squeeze the milk out of these cells. And actually, when a baby sucks, it doesn't suck the milk out of the breast. It just stimulates the breast to secrete milk. And then around the outside here, you have what's called the basement membrane. So this is just a tough outer layer. It's an example of the extracellular matrix. So this would be a normal duct, a nice lots of opening. Now you begin to have cells going into that empty space, that's hyperplasia. You've got more and more of those cells, things are getting worse. And then when you've got a lot of clogging, that's called DCIS, ductal carcinoma in situ, so this is stage zero cancer. And then sometimes these cells start to break out, and when they break out of the ducts, then you've got invasive ductal cancer. So that would be stage one and higher when it becomes invasive. So the cell microenvironment, the supporting environment is called the stroma. The stroma consists of two parts. It's the extracellular matrix, which I'll call the ECM. That's just a mesh of proteins and sugars outside the cells. ECM sits between cells. That's the interstitial matrix. And there's this basement membrane that I just pointed to, which support the epithelial cells that are in the duct. And then the stroma also consists not just of ECM, but the cells that make that ECM. And these are primarily fibroblasts. So this is just a picture I got off the web of the ECM being out here. This is the lipid bilayer. And then in here, you've got the cell. These are integrins, which are your part of the focal adhesions that connect the outside to the inside. And these can relay mechanical as well as chemical signals between the cell and the ECM.
That's for the particular ECM, the picture, or for general ECM?
This is general. This is in general.
Do you know how it differs, the ECM?
Between the interstitial and the basement membrane?
No, I mean for this particular, for the breast cells that you're talking about, for the breast tumors.
No, not offhand. Why is the... Except that, you know, except just the structure, the basement membrane is what I was mostly referring to. And so how is that different from the interstitial matrix? That I'm not sure about. Maybe someone else knows. One thing to note is that with aging, there are more cracks in this basement membrane on the outside, so that degradation can allow things to go in and out and cause possibly be a way of allowing more toxins in. So the question I had, and this is then the third question, is really what's the role of the stiffness of the microenvironment in transforming pre-malignant mammary epithelial cells into invasive breast cancer? And so let me talk a little bit about the tumor microenvironment. As I said, Mina Bissell will be here in a month, and she's really the person who did the seminal work. And one of the key experiments that she did, she's at Lawrence Berkeley National Lab, just north of here, is that maybe for what they did is they took a cancer-causing virus, the Ross sarcoma virus that Arnie Levine talked about, and they injected it into a chicken. And so the tumor grew on the wing of the chicken where they injected the virus. But the odd thing was, if they look inside the chicken, the virus is all throughout the chicken. The tumor only grew at one spot, and that's where they injected the virus. So the virus was not by itself enough to cause cancer. And then when they cut the other wing, the tumor grew there. So you needed not just the virus, but you needed a wound, some damage to the microenvironment in order to produce this tumor. And therein gives you a hint that the environment of the cells also is a key player, can be a key player in causing malignancy. There was another experiment which was done here by Purcellus and Hoff, and where they took tissue, and this is in vivo, this is inside a mouse, and they irradiated that tissue. And then they put basically pre-malignant cells on that irradiated stroma and a tumor grew. But if they took the pre-malignant cells and put it on tissue that had no irradiation, no previous irradiation, tumor did not grow. So it was the fact that they irradiated the stroma that somehow provided an environment for the tumor to grow. And these, interestingly, are what are called coma D cells. They have two P53 alleles. So the idea is that damaging the microenvironment can cause pre-malignant cells to become malignant.
I have a question. Mm-hmm. So putting the needle into the chicken wing can cause kind of a release of pre-malignant cells. So is that anything to do with the inflammation?
It's not released, but it's sort of like, it can have, yes, definitely. Inflammation is known to be an important player
that
in cancer.
That can change the microenvironment too, probably.
That can be, yeah, because once you do cause a wound, then all inflammatory factors, immune system, a lot of things come into play. So what is it of all of those things? I mean, that's an open question. But the virus alone, interestingly, Mina Bissell also injected the RSV into an embryo, chicken embryo. A little chicken embryo grew up into a healthy, fine, mature adult chicken. Nothing happened. So, just to refresh your memory, the cells can communicate with their stroma, with the ECM, via these focal adhesions. The cell puts down anchors itself to the extracellular matrix. And this assembly of proteins called the focal adhesion, that's able to transmit not only mechanical forces, but chemical forces. And then a key player in these focal adhesions are the integrins, which are transmembrane proteins that link the ECM molecules like collagen to the cytoskeleton-like actin. The importance of the cell being able to anchor itself to the ECM and this playing a key role in the development of cancer was shown in an experiment done by Val Weaver when she was a postdoc in Mina Bissell's lab. And what she did was, this is what normal cells, mammary epithelial cells, grown in a dish look like, right? And these are malignant tumor cells. They look like this. And what Weaver did was she treated these cells with an inhibitory beta-1 integrin antibody. In other words, she basically made the integrins, she cut the connections of the integrins with the ECM. using this antibody. And when she did that for these malignant cells, they reverted to a normal phenotype. Right, so this is sort of like, you know, the magic bullet. What you'd love to see is take a tumor, treat it with some antibody, and it turns into a normal phenotype.
There are other types of integrins other than beta 1 that also do the same trick, or?
That I don't know, but if they didn't use inhibitory, if they used the excitatory ones, it didn't work. And interestingly, when they injected this into inhibitory integrin antibody into a tumor, into a mouse with a tumor, the tumor shrank and it didn't seem to bother the normal cells. So I asked Mina Bissell why this isn't in the clinic. You would think this would be a great treatment. She said, well, they didn't patent the antibody, but there is evidence that with this antibody you need less radiation, 80% less radiation, so some company is looking into that use. Okay, so tumors are stiff. You feel for a lump, actually, right? And so how stiff are they? And how do the elastic properties of cells in their microenvironment affect their growth and behavior? So here's sort of a stiffness chart. And this comes from a review article by the Weaver. So glass and plastic are 2 to 4 gigapascals. Typical mammary or breast tissue is 100, 200 pascals. If you look at an average tumor, it's about 4,000 pascals. The stroma attached to that tumor is about 1,000, so it's about, the stroma is about 1,000, 5 times stiffer than normal tissue. The tumor is about 10 times stiffer than normal tissue. So there's a very interesting, intriguing experiment done in Val Weaver's lab. She's at UC San Francisco. And what they did was they did this both in vivo and in vitro. They took pre-malignant breast cancer cells and they stiffened the collagen, the extracellular matrix. Let's back up. If you take breast cancer cells or breast cells, mammary epithelial cells, you put them in a dish, what happens? They form little balls, they form little spheres called acini. Because, you know, breast cells, normally these cells want to form tubes and ducts in the breast. When you put them in a dish, they form little balls called acini. And so she took these pre-malignant cells and she stiffened the collagen around them by adding ribose, cross-linking the collagen. And when she did that, then the pre-malignant cells became malignant and became invasive. If she did not stiffen the collagen, they didn't become invasive. They kind of filled up the ball, but they did not become invasive and they didn't break out. So again, this is a hint that if you stiffen the microenvironment, it induces transformation of pre-malignant cells into malignant cells.
Is this on a 3D culture or is
this has got to be, yeah, this is 3D. This is in collagen, so I think it's 3D, yeah. And I don't know if you're interested, these are the premalignant cells. They're sort of cells that look like normal mammary epithelial cells. If you add a drug to them, you make them premalignant. So they stop forming nice little acini, they form sort of weird things, but they're not invasive per se, they just kind of, their morphology changes. But the nice thing is you can induce premalignancy by adding a drug. And that was developed by Muthuswamy and Joan Brugge's lab. So our hypothesis is that elastic or mechanical interactions between cells and stroma helps to determine the cell fate, and in particular that if you increase the mechanical stiffness of the tumor microenvironment, the question is, will premalignant cells become malignant and invasive? And that's certainly the implication from the Weaver lab. So we really think that you need more quantitative measurements than just the sort of pictures I showed. And the Weaver Lab did do quantitative measurements. So here is some of the measurements of stiffness. This is the elastic modulus for normal tissue, about 200. For the premalignant cells, it's 600, and then for the tumor and the stroma, the tumor is almost 2,000, about 2,000 pascals. But the interesting thing is, if you look at the uncross-linked collagen, the stiffness is about 100 pascals. She stiffens it, and it increases at 50% to 150 pascals, and that's enough stiffness, increase in stiffness, presumably to cause this invasive behavior. And yet this stiffness is comparable to the stiffness in ordinary breast tissue. So it seems a little like maybe the cells are very sensitive. Yeah.
Is that a question of the cells not being able to reorganize the collagen if the ribose is there?
Sorry, what?
I mean, usually the cells will reorganize the collagen network around.
Yeah.
And what happens if you cross-link the network?
So that's what the ribose does when they add it.
Yeah, but then is it really a question of stiffness or just of reorganization of the network?
Okay, I think I have to go back and look at this paper, but I think this is, my guess is that this is without the cells. This is with the collagen, and this is cross-linked collagen with cross-linked by ribose. But my guess is that this is the stiffness of the collagen without the cells and their remodeling the ECM. I think that's what we can go back and take a look at the paper, but I think that's what the way, but you're absolutely right. So that cells can remodel the surroundings, and certainly when you see the stiffer stroma around tumors, that obviously has been what's been going on. And there are also signals sent to the fibroblasts to make them sort of make stiffer stroma and so forth. Those are the CAFs, cancer-assisting fibroblasts or something, CAFs. Okay, so what we'd like to do is, how can we answer these questions? And so I've teamed up with an experimentalist, Elliot Botvinnik, in the biomedical engineering department at Irvine, and he's invented this cute little device that we've affectionately named Mr. Twisty. And so the idea is to take memory epithelial cells and grow them 3D in a dish of Matrigel, and as I said, these cells will form a sphere, a little ball, and this is the Petri dish, and then you have a post coming out, and what you can do is just turn the post a little bit. And so if you think of this as some gel in here, if you turn the post, then you're going to stress the gel, and you're going to stiffen it, and you're going to pull on basically the gel and the cells inside there, right? So you take it and you just twist it and you leave it twisted. And the question is, when you increase the stiffness of the ECM by this mechanical post, will the premalignant cells become malignant? And so the nice thing is that they have, as I was saying, I wanted to see more quantitative measurements, and they're able to use microrheology to measure the stiffness on a micron scale. And the way they do that is just take little beads and shake them with optical tweezers, optical laser traps. And if it's soft, then if you shake it, you can see the bead move a lot, and if it's stiff, you shake it and it won't move very much. So you can measure the stiffness, and then our goal is to model those results. So as you all know, this is the stiffness is the shear modulus, is what they're going to be measuring. So this is the stress, the force versus the strain, and that gives you the slope. And it's analogy to F equals minus kx, k would be the spring stiffness. Okay, so the way that rheology is normally measured, this is macrorheology, is what you do is you take your sample and you put it between two plates and you twist the top plate and you see how much deformation for a given amount of twist you have in your sample. So this is a rheometer, and that is typically how you measure stiffness. But the thing is, if you look at the scale of this is 5 centimeters. That's huge on the scale of a cell, right? And so one would like to do things on a more microscopic level, because the stiffness of the ECM is going to be very heterogeneous. So that's why this microrheology, active microrheology AMR is what they call it. And the idea, as I said, is you take a little bead in an optical trap and you wiggle it back and forth and you see how much it moves. You know the amount of force you're applying, you can measure the local stiffness, the shear modulus. So they've done this, for example, for collagen. This is, I guess this is fibrin gel going from 2.5 gigapascals up to 10 gigapascals. And the thing is that the average, so black here, this is on a log scale, the stiffness, the shear modulus versus the frequency. Seems pretty flat as a function of frequency, but you can see the black line is the real part, the gray line is the imaginary part. And basically, as you increase the fibrin concentration, it gets stiffer and stiffer, the blue box stays fixed. So the fact that you see the black line moving above the blue box means it's stiffer. But if you look from point to point, there's an enormous spread in the local stiffness, right? And even though the average gives you one measure, you can see orders of magnitude difference in stiffness just from point to point. So there's a large variance. And so in fact, they've measured the stiffness. This is a smooth muscle cell, and these are beads that are about 2 microns in diameter. These beads, this is the cell here, these beads are 40 microns apart, and yet they see, I think, about an order of magnitude difference in the stiffness between these 2 points. Whoops. So you can get an enormous change in stiffness, just very small change in space, 40 microns apart, about an order of magnitude difference in stiffness. So what we'd like to do and what we are doing is take some of these memory epithelial cells, put them in a dish, and they form a SNI. So we've got the cells and they've got them forming a SNI. And then you put some beads in the ECM and you measure the local stiffness. You ask, how can it affect growth? So these are the SNI. You can see that they're on the order of about 100 microns, these balls of cells.
How does that change with time?
So initially when you put them in, they don't form, they haven't made a SNI, and you've got to wait a few days, and then they make a SNI, of course. One of the things that changes in time is the actual environment, which is Matrigel. So one of the things I found surprising in these experiments is that you think the whole problem with cancer is we can't get it to stop growing, right? That's what's killing people. And yet, if you put them in a dish, they're very, very picky, and they won't grow a lot of the time unless everything is just right. I mean, they're like prima donnas. And when you order something like Matrigel, we've heard this word, and you know, you just order a bottle of it. Different bottles have different Matrigel. So some of the Matrigel comes with, you know, it doesn't have enough proteins, and you know, then the cells aren't happy and they die. And so you've got to get not only just Matrigel, it's got to be the right lot, right, of Matrigel. And we've actually found that, so what is Matrigel? It's, you basically take mouse sarcoma cells, so you take some cancer cells, you grind it up, and you take sort of the collagen and the growth factors out of that, and that gives you what's called this goop called Matrigel. And actually, the weird thing is, so if you look at, we've looked at, or Elliott's Lab looked at the real part of the stiffness versus whether you're near the SNI or far from it, Matrigel turns out to soften with time. So if you take it, here it is at day 5, this is near the SNI, you've got 35 pascals, far from the SNI, it's a little softer, it's 29. 7 days later, 1 week later, near the SNI it's 7 pascals and here it's 5. And so the question is, does Matrigel soften with time?
But it's with the SNI.
What?
Without a SNI, what's happened?
Without a SNI, it softens, so I'm going to show you that. So here is cell-free. This is the Matrigel incubated 37 degrees centigrade. This is the stiffness in pascals versus day, and you can just see it just cell-free, it softens. So even the stuff you're, you know, you have to look at all these things and be careful. So this is Elliot, and he's the one that invented this ingeniously simple little device called Mr. Twisty. This is what Mr. Twisty really looks like. This is the Petri dish, and that's a little post. And you turn a little set screw, and that basically turns the lever arm. And he has this analogy with the spaghetti and stuff. I guess the idea is that if you, the gel forms this, you've got this matrix around the cells, and then which are the matrix that are like spaghetti, and if you start twisting on these strands, then you're going to be pulling on the cell. And so they've actually, if you're near the post, this is from finite element analysis, if you're near the post, you have a very high strain. As you go away from the post, you have lower strain, and they've actually gone and measured that, and that's in fact what happens. So if you look for an 18-degree twist, you have very near the post, you have very high stiffness, about 1,000 pascals, which is a tumor stiffness. If you're far from the post, it's very soft, it's a collagen 10 pascals. And in the middle, you can actually get stiffness that's corresponding to normal mammary gland stiffness. So you can imagine that if you grow cells in here, they will feel everything from very soft to normal stiffness to a very stiff environment.
How long does it last? Because I guess after that the gel will flow.
The gel will soften and stuff. Yeah, so we have to pay attention to that. And one cure might be to mix in some collagen with the matrix gel and try to keep it stiff that way. But those are measurements that we actually...
This is a 2D calculation.
This is not a calculation.
Adhering to the bottom.
Huh? This is not 2D. This is 3D.
Okay, so it depends also on where you are on height of your.
Yeah, and I think it.
Is it adhering to the bottom or not?
Is it adhering to the bottom? I don't know. I have to ask. I don't. But this is just talking about. Are you talking about cells or the matrix gel?
Matrix gel. Because
gel.
Basically, what as far as I understand, you get the stiffening due to strain stiffening. I mean, mm-hmm. that's known for collagen gels mm-hmm. that they strain mm-hmm. stiffen. And you're imposing a strain, mm-hmm. and that's creating the stiffening. But the mm-hmm. strain will be extremely non-uniform if it's adhering at the bottom.
I think it doesn't adhere, but I'll have to ask.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay, that I have to ask. They've actually grown muscle cells, smooth muscle cells in Mr. Twisty. And they find that it aligns, the cells align with the direction of the strain field. So as you go around, the cells tend to align with that strain. And far from the post, they're just a mess. So so the idea here is that what we're trying to do now is to grow the cells in this 3D matrix gel culture. We put the beads in the ECM. You increase the stiffness by turning the post and measure the local stiffness as a function of position and see if this causes the pre-malignant cells to become malignant.
Could you just elaborate on this point that the stiffness is kind of like the relevant thing to measure or to think about in the sense that, you know, like it seems like also like the alignment of fibers is changing and presumably stiffness may be different because of like pore size is different or something like that. And why is like stiffness the right thing to be thinking about as opposed to other aspects?
That's a good question. I think that you have to say, you know, the hypothesis is that stiffness is the thing that matters, and the question is, what is it that the cells are what is it that the integrins feel, and are the integrins just measuring stiffness? What I erased from this slide is that some of the questions I had was, you know, so the first thing to look at is the stiffness and whether that the magnitude of the stiffness and how the phenotype of the cell changes with that, right? That's the first thing to look at. One can then look and say, wait a minute, is it really maybe it's the time rate of change of the stiffness. Maybe something has to happen over time. As you said, maybe it's really the pore size in there that it's looking at. Another thing might be the gradient, though I think these acini are so small and the cells are so small that it's not really going to see much of a gradient on this length scale. So that's, you know, that's a possibility. And what we want to look at and I think other groups are looking at is sort of, you know, the integrin signaling and how that's that's going to be affected. So the next step would be to sort of look at what they see.
Is the stiffness isotropic? So I mean, you're applying a strain, right? And then you can imagine that the stiffness perpendicular to the strain and parallel to the strain is different.
You could, and I think that's something that's in principle measurable. I think it doesn't change that much because it's just on the micron scale.
No, the scales would depend. I mean, if it is the strain stiffening of the collagen, right, then
yeah.
If you're only straining in one direction,
right.
stiff, and in the opposite direction, you're very soft.
Yeah, I think the fact that these cells align in the strain field is evidence
for that there is.
Yes.
But that
no, you're
measurable
right.
with this optical.
Yes. So it's a function. I mean, this in principle, shear modulus is a function of K and omega, right? And K is a vector, so the strain field.
What's the time lapse here, the time between the frames of the alignment?
It's just as a function of
ABCD, it's a function of the position, or?
Yeah, this is just a function of position around the post.
How long does it take for the cells to be aligned?
That I'm not sure. I'd have to look at the paper of how many it. So that I can, this has been published in PLOS One, so I can show you the paper. Okay, so as I said, the question is, if you stiffen it, do the premalignant cells become malignant? The short answer is, we don't know. We have some very preliminary results. So this is far from the post, you form a nice acini. If you get close to the post, you begin to see this sort of invasive behavior. And actually, these are cells that we didn't give. These are non-malignant, non-drug cells, so they're not pre-malignant, supposedly. This is after you give it that little dimerizer drug, and then they begin to become more perhaps invasive. This is near the post. Far from it, you just have this sort of amorphous morphology. But this is very preliminary, and so I'm not willing to hang my hat on this. There's just sort of some tantalizing preliminary results. Okay, I'm straight up on 3 o'clock. I'll just tell you real quick that one thing we'd like to do is go back and look at, as you were asking about the integrin signaling, it's known that an important factor is that the integrins, which are these proteins, transmembrane proteins that anchor the ECM, the cell to the ECM and connect it to the cytoskeleton, when they feel stresses and strains, they tend to cluster, and that's important to the signaling. And they may, in fact, be coupled to some other signaling growth factors, the tyrosine kinase ones. So there's some. One thing we'd like to do is sort of to examine what does a cell do when it has a little force on it. And so a neat thing to do would be, this is a proposed experiment, is to take a bead, coat it with ECM, with fibronectin, and allow a cell's integrins to attach to it and then pull that bead away as a function of force and measure the force and see what the integrins do as a result of that. And then we'd like to be able to then model that. I've got a postdoc that's begun to model how integrins, perhaps under force, come together. And also, with regard to the first part of the talk, we have been doing some modeling in developmental, the wing disc of the fruit fly embryo, Drosophila embryo, and we think asymmetric distribution of cationins causes enhances growth, and we'd like to maybe take some of the things we've learned from those simulations and adapt them to how these mammary epithelial cells grow in response to the stiffness of the ECM. So anyway, this is just a summary of what we're trying to do. I think that the tumor microenvironment can play a key role in the tumor development and inhibition, and we're using Mr. Twisty and some modeling to try to understand how the role of the stiffness of the tumor microenvironment in transferring malignant into tumorigenic cells. This is Elliot Botnick, whom I've mentioned. His st- student, Abhishek Karup, has been working really hard. This is my student, Julie Wortman, who I sent her into the lab to try to help Abhishek, and they've been growing cells. Thea Tilsty has been very kind in helping to provide cells and a lot of advice from her group up at UC San Francisco. And in case you don't know about it, this is a great book to read. Emperor of All Maladies, it won a Pulitzer Prize, but it's a fascinating discussion of the history of cancer. So with that, I'll go ahead and I should just sort of mention that this work was funded as a pilot project with the Princeton PS Physical Sciences Oncology Center. Great. Thank you.
So the matrix gel contains like 60% of stuff rather than the collagen, and also it's collagen 4 rather than collagen type 1. Mm-hmm. That actually changes the result, because I think real tissue contains more collagen 1 rather than collagen 4.
Okay, yeah, right. So this has collagen 4 in it, and that's possible. You know, so that would be something that we'd look at as a control, possibly by adding. I mean, do you use, in your lab, do you use?
I think we use one, but we don't use matrix gel anyway.
What do you use?
Just collagen.
You just use collagen?
Right.
Yeah, so we were mixing, thinking of mixing collagen. Occasionally we do, I think, do that, mix collagen with the.
What is collagen 1 and collagen 4?
I think it's just different isotopes.
Different what?
Isotopes. Different isoforms.
Isoforms. Oh, isoforms, right.
Isotopes.
What are the few different isoforms?
So, I mean, are you familiar with the different isoforms? Whether they have more repeat structures or one kind of structures? Yeah. So, I'm not sure either.
Just usually isoform means that it looks basically the same, just a few amino acids are different.
In terms of primary structure, sequence is slightly different.
Yes, that's what I understand. Usually the primary structure is slightly different, but everything else looks
even
more or less the same.
Splicing, you get different isoforms of the same product.
Yeah, you can have more repeats of something, for example. I'm sure if we Google it, we find it.
Yeah, you mentioned that upper breast has higher incidence of cancer. And did you relate that to stiffness or just kind of structure?
We want to. We haven't. Nobody's looked at that. All they do is just look at the factors. So.
Looks similar, no?
Yeah, it looks similar, and so the question is whether, is there really, you know, you have 50%, 11%, this is actually 47%, 11%, is it really stiffer in the upper half or not? And the question is, I think it would be interesting either way. If you find more mammographic density in the upper half, okay, maybe that there is a correlation. If you don't find more, then there's some other reason why you have more in one breast than the other. So that's sort of this question of location, right? You have to blame all the food and everything. Your whole body is subjected to the same food that you've eaten.
And also, why do you put the post at a side away from in the dish rather than put in the center? So just feel
you can do it either way. I think you can move the post either to the concentric position or off center. If you do it off center, then you get more variety or variation in the stiffness.
Okay.
So if you want to sample different stiffnesses, and that's kind of what we wanted to do, then you put it off center.
Can you put the cells after the formation, or do you have to put them before applying the stress? Because if you're putting them before applying the stress, there's both an increase in density in young modulus, but you also submitted them to a strain. Whereas if you add them later, they'll just see the change in modulus. Can you see the difference?
Yeah, you could. I think you could do both, and that's something we've thought of and we'd like to do, is to say, okay, suppose you take it and you stress it, and then see how they grow. Whether you stress it before, whether the cells are born seeing the strain field, or whether they're born without the strain field, and then you can maybe stress it. And those are two things that we'd like to look at when we've done that.
I don't know.
other than cross-linking or twisting, any other ways to change the stiffness?
You know, you can always try different gels. So if you look at the Weaver paper, they did use, for example, polyacrylamide. Not so much to look at invasion, but to look at the expression of some things downstream.
So you could
look, try different gels, for example, different things to grow the cells in, I think.
Okay. One of the time.